Shrink Wrap Radio Number 50, September 8, 2006. Ericksonian Hypnotherapy and Solution Oriented Therapy. Welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio, the planet's premier psychology podcast. This is your host, Dr. Dave, coming to you from the San Francisco Bay Area. Shrink Wrap Radio is the show that speaks from the psychologist in me to the psychologist in you, whether you be amateur, student, or professional.
Erickson did many, many things, but one of the things he did was he tried to find what was working in people's lives, what resources and abilities he had. He was really a resource-oriented therapist at base, and that influenced me so much because what I was learning in graduate school and undergraduate school was pathology, what was wrong with people, what had damaged people, what genetic problems they had, what biochemical problems they had, what personality problems they had, what traumas they had suffered, what bad environments they'd been in, or where they were stuck. And, you know, it's useful stuff to know, I think. But sometimes when we focus on it, we lose one part of the therapeutic benefits of things, which is people get discouraged. And we know that hope and positive expectancy has a great deal to do with positive outcomes in psychotherapy.
That was the voice of Bill O'Hanlon. I first heard about Bill O'Hanlon's work from my friend, Dr. Ron Alexander. I don't know how I missed him before, inasmuch as I've long been a fan of the work of Milton Erickson, and Bill is one of the main expositors of that work. Bill is the author of 27 books, several of which are about the work of the famed hypnotherapist Milton Erickson. And out of that work, Bill has developed his own psychotherapeutic approach, which he calls solution-oriented therapy. His clinical work is recognized for its collaborative, respectful approach to clients, and he's known for his storytelling, his irreverent humor, his clear and accessible presentation style, and his psychotic enthusiasm for whatever he's doing. And by the way, that description of psychotic enthusiasm is his wording, not mine. It comes off his website. Bill conducts workshops all over the U.S. and internationally as well. In 1999, he appeared on Oprah with his book, Do One Thing Different, 10 Simple Ways to Change Your Life. He's also appeared on The Today Show, Canada AM, and Body by Jake. His work has been featured in Ladies Home Journal, New Woman, Newsweek, Bottom Line, Self, and The Psychotherapy Networker. So, let's get into the interview. Bill, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thanks for having me here.
Well, Bill, you've had such a diverse and prolific career that it's going to be extremely challenging to try to capture it in an interview of a half hour or so. The pieces I'd like to touch on are your work with Erickson, with Ericksonian hypnosis and therapy, and then moving on to your involvement with NLP, and then on to your more recent work developing solution-oriented therapy. So let's start out with Milton Erickson. I'm not sure how many of my listeners will have even heard of Milton Erickson. So
well,
I wonder if you...
It's good that you use his first name, because a lot of people think when you say Erickson, they think Eric Erickson, who was a prominent psychologist who had a great contribution to the field. But Milton Erickson, also Scandinavian, but a whole different can of worms.
That's right. So can you give us a quick education about who he was, why he was so significant, and why we're still talking about him today, even though he passed away some years ago?
Well, he was a psychiatrist, psychologist. Actually, he was trained in both fields. He had an MA in psychology that he got simultaneously with getting his MD, and he later went on to become a psychiatrist. And that was in the 20s and the 30s when he did his training. So at the time, there wasn't much in the way of medication. So psychiatry was either psychoanalysis or, as they called it, sort of asylum running. You ran an asylum or you worked in an asylum where they put the crazy people, and it was like a snake pit in some ways. It wasn't always as bad at every institution, but Erickson worked in those institutions and tried to make them more humane and also tried to work out clinical ways of helping people without medications before they had a lot of the tools, and he wasn't that big on psychoanalysis. He was a farm kid from Wisconsin, mm-hmm. and he was a lot more practical. He just thought, it's got to be more practical than having people be on a couch reassociating for years. And he came up with very creative ways of working with some of the most difficult people. Then in his 40s, he moved to Phoenix and was more in private practice. He had health problems, which we'll talk about probably for a moment. And he opened a private practice after he left the Arizona State Asylum, where he was the director for a little while, the medical director, and was in private practice from the late 40s until his death in 1980. He gave up his practice a few years before, but he still saw students in Phoenix, Arizona, which is where I met him. I was at Arizona State University, and he came to buy something at the art gallery where I was working as a work-study student, and I came across his work, and I was very, very intrigued because it was different from what I was learning in my psychology program at Arizona State.
I'll bet it was different. Now, there's so many... There are so many Erickson miracle stories of his fantastic interventions. I wonder if you recall one or two that you could share with us.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's actually the challenge of studying Erickson's work. Jeff Zeig said that as Freud was to the theory of psychotherapy, Erickson was to the clinical practice of psychotherapy. He was just endlessly creative, but also he was a little weird is all I can say. I mean, you know, not to be disrespectful, but he was so creative, and he came at things on in a sideways way mm-hmm. rather than a straightforward way. So he liked to create a new intervention for each person that he worked with. So it made it a little challenging to work with him. The other thing, as you mentioned, some of the stories sound... They're like movies. I mean, they're weird movies in terms
yes.
of they sound so unbelievable and so amazing that if you were a student of his or if you read about his work, one of the best books is Uncommon Therapy by Jay Haley.
Right.
And you read that book, and I read that book, and I had two simultaneously sort of opposite responses. I was exhilarated. And I was so excited about his work. At the same time, I was very discouraged because I thought, I'll never be able to do what this guy does. Never,
well, there's a third reaction that I had. I had both of those two. But there's been a lingering skepticism, to be honest. I mean, was he prone to exaggeration
sure.
at all? How much hyperbole is in there?
I don't think he was. I think he, you know, like anyone who tells a story, sometimes they edit the story or sometimes they combine them. But, you know, on your side of the fence is Albert Ellis, who I met with briefly when I went to New York one time. We had a mutual acquaintance, and the mutual acquaintance got us together, and he said, "You don't believe any of those Erickson stories, do you?" Ellis said, and I said, "Well, yeah, I do believe them." And he said, "They're totally made up. That couldn't happen. That's not the way psychotherapy goes." Well, it certainly isn't the way psychotherapy goes for Ellis, but there are two things that I guess I would say in Erickson's defense. The truth is, I don't know. Jeff Zeig investigated, Jeff Zeig is the head of the Erickson Foundation and one of Erickson's followers and disciples who sort of took over the mantle of Erickson's work after he died, investigated some of these cases that sounded so incredible and
oh,
was able
good.
To find the factual basis for them. So he did investigate a few,
good.
But that still doesn't say that they were all true. I'll tell you this, though. Because I was so discouraged but also so inspired when I read about Erickson's work and learned about it from him, I began to work in this way, and I have truly had not exactly the same things that Erickson had, but I've had some amazing results in a very short amount of time. So at least theoretically, some of them are possible. But let me tell you the story that grabbed me about Erickson, because I could tell you Erickson stories for years, but for way more than half an hour. I was in that art gallery working, and Erickson came up to buy an art object that he collected. He collected Seri Indian wood carvings, hardwood carvings from the Sonoran Desert, and they sold them at the art gallery in which I worked.
Okay.
And when he left, I helped him down to his car. When I came back to the art gallery, my fellow student, who was a work-study student there, said, "You know who that was?" And I said, "No." And they said, you should. You know, he's a famous psychiatrist, and you're in psychology. And they showed me an article that was in Time magazine that week. Strange coincidence, it was sort of kismet or fate that I would meet him and that this article would be right there. And it described a case that totally intrigued me and hooked me for the rest of my life on Erickson, because it was so different and because he seemed fearless and creative and also respectful in a certain way, even though he was sometimes quite challenging of his patients. This woman was suicidal. She'd been raised by parents who let her know clearly she was an accident, and they didn't really want her, but they raised her minimally. They fed her, they clothed her, they sent her to school. No love, no affection. And they had died in their when she was in her mid-20s, and she had just drifted since then. She didn't have any close relatives, she didn't have any close friends, and she worked at a job, but she didn't really love her work. And after some years, in her late 20s, she came to Erickson and said, you know, I have made a rational decision that life isn't worth living, and I'm going to kill myself in 3 months. Mm-hmm. But I thought any person should examine this. This is a pretty serious decision. Any person should examine this with the help of a psychiatrist from every angle to make sure it's the right decision, because it's irrevocable. And I would like your help. I would like you to agree not to try and stop me from killing myself, but to help me examine whether life could be worth living, is worth living, or whether I've made the right decision. So Erickson agrees, if she agrees to follow all of his directives, as long as they're not unethical or immoral or illegal. She agrees, and off they go. She doesn't have much to say about her life. She doesn't have any happy memories. She doesn't like herself very well. In fact, she thinks she's quite disgusting and that no one will like her, no one would ever marry her, no one would be a friend with her. And one of the worst things she thinks is that she has an eighth of an inch gap in her two front teeth that she considers to be hideous and forming. And that's partly what makes her so ugly. Erickson looks at it and can barely see this gap in her two front teeth, but he says, okay, in the first session, your assignment is to go home, and while you're in the shower, practice squirting water through that gap in your teeth until you can squirt it with an accuracy of 8 to 10 feet. Now, this is different from any psychiatrist she's ever heard of.
I would say so.
Weird, but he reminds her of her agreement to cooperate fully with treatment as long as it's not unethical or illegal or harmful. So they go on, and he can't get much out of her about her childhood. And he says, you know, tell me about your life now. And she tells him. And one of the things she says intrigues him, because she works at a construction firm. She works as a receptionist secretary. And he said, anything, you know, do you like about your work or dislike? And she said, well, it's okay, but there's a guy at work who bugs me all the time. He, you know, when I go to the drinking fountain, he always seems to make an excuse to go to the drinking fountain and try and talk to me, and I quickly beat a retreat to my desk because I know he's just laughing at me. And Erickson gets the idea that maybe this guy's interested in her. So he asks her, do you have any money saved? And she has $5,000 saved. Now, this case is from the 1950s, so $5,000 is a lot of money. And he says, well, you know, what's going to happen to that money when you die? And she said, I don't know. I don't care. It'll go to the state. I don't have any relatives or anybody I care about or any charities I really care about. He said, well, why don't you spend some of that money and indulge yourself and have a good time? So she said, what for? And he said, well, I'm your psychiatrist and I'm prescribing that. So he gets her set up with a clothing shop that gives her a total makeover. He gets her set up with a beauty salon that gives her a makeover with her hair and tells her how to do her makeup and her hair and her nails and things like that. She's looking better and she's feeling a little better, but still not, life isn't worth living. So Erickson says, okay, tell me about one good memory. She said, I don't have any good memories. He said, well, no one should die without at least one good memory. Let's create one for you. She says, well, that's impossible. He said, no, it's not impossible. Here's his plan. On Monday morning, she's to get dressed up in her best clothes, fix her hair, do her makeup, do her nails, and she's to go to work. When she goes to the drinking fountain and that guy shows up, she's to get a mouthful of water and she's to squirt it at him through the gap in her teeth. She's to take one step towards him and turn around and run like hell. This appalls her. No way is she going to do this, but he reminds her of her agreement and finally she reluctantly agrees to do it. Of course she does it on that Monday morning. She follows his instructions exactly, squirts the water through the gap in her teeth at this guy, takes one step towards him, turns around and runs, and he runs after her and catches her, spins her around, and gives her a kiss, which totally discombobulates her, which ultimately leads to a flirtation that begins at work and ends with them going out on a date, which totally blows her mind. and begins to, you know, make a dent in this idea that no one could ever love her, no one could ever like her, and she gives up her suicide plans. Now, I close the magazine that I'm reading, and I'm thinking, they're not teaching me that in psychology school.
Right.
I don't know where he came up with that, how he got the guts to do something like that, how he thought of something that creative, how he knew it would work. And, you know, to go back to your earlier question, I mean, number one, I was intrigued. Number two, I couldn't figure out how he did it, which I know how he did it now because I've studied it for many years and I've written many books about it. But also, I think that he didn't tell us the stories of the people he told to squirt the water through the gap in her teeth and she killed herself. I think Erikson, one of the things that Erikson liked to pay attention to was what worked. So he told lots of stories about what worked, and we didn't hear too many stories about his clinical failures.
Uh-huh.
But the ones that worked were very, very intriguing. They were a lot of them were like that. Some of them even weirder, where he learned to talk word salad, like a schizophrenic patient of his was talking, and started to communicate to this guy in his own language of word salad. Another guy who would move compulsively and who'd been a successful businessman, Erikson changed the movements, got the guy interested in woodworking, and ultimately got him out of the hospital. I mean, he had so many creative interventions. He would just use what people were already doing or what they thought was a problem, like the gap in the teeth, like the word salad, like the compulsive hand movements, and he would channel them into creative and productive endeavors to help people move out of their problems. And he had such a philosophy that ultimately, we'll talk about this in a little while, but I came up with an approach called solution-oriented therapy that was based on one part of what Erikson did, which was to find people's resources, strengths, their abilities, rather than their deficits or pathologies or problems or traumas.
Wow. That's a great recap. And if listeners are interested in learning more of these stories, you mentioned Jay Haley's book, Uncommon Therapy, which has a wonderful collection of them. Also, I started reading one of your books, and unfortunately, I don't have it in front of me, and so I don't recall the title. Taproots, yes.
Taproots was a book that I wrote about Erikson's hypnosis and therapy. He did hypnotherapy and hypnosis, as well as psychotherapy, and sometimes he combined them, and sometimes they were separate. And I tried to find the patterns, and we're going to talk about neurolinguistic programming in a minute, but I had learned from neurolinguistic programming actually before I studied with Erikson to look for patterns, to search for patterns. And I didn't think anybody had gotten Erikson's patterns as completely. Bandler and Grinder, who started neurolinguistic programming, got some of them. Jay Haley got a few of them. And there were a few other people that articulated a few, but I didn't think anybody had a great overview of Erikson's patterns. And so I got I don't have a great tolerance for confusion. Erikson's specialty was confusion.
Yeah.
So in the 5 years after he died, I devoted myself to figuring out what the heck he was doing that I couldn't figure out.
Mm-hmm.
He taught like a Zen master. He wouldn't explain anything. He just gave you experiences. And in that way, it was great learning, but in another way, for cognitive purposes, or to teach it to anybody else, except if you were going to communicate it, again, like a Zen master does, one-on-one, it was very hard to teach. So I wanted to teach everybody, because I was so excited about Erikson's work, I wanted everybody in the world to know about it. So I spent 5 years obsessing about it, reading it over and over again, listening to the tapes that I'd made, tapes that other people had made, and I've made sense of it in a particular way, which is what that book Taproots was about. There's another great book about Erikson, not by me, but by Sidney Rosen, called My Voice Will Go With You,
which is
a collection of stories that Erikson told, that some of them are clinical and some of them are just life stories, and they're quite charming. I had a friend who would read those stories to his child as a bedtime story.
My goodness.
And his kid wanted to hear them over and over and over again. I don't know what his kid grew up like, but I've lost touch with him. But I'm sure that kid is either creative or warped in a particular way. So.
Yeah, I wish I had discovered your book earlier. You do a wonderful job of extracting basic principles. And I'm not in clinical practice anymore, but I would have found it very valuable at the time that I was. So you went on, actually, after that encounter in the art gallery where you were working, I believe you went on to become his gardener as a way to kind of get inside, right?
Correct. Well, yes, as a way to get inside, because I didn't have any money. I was in undergraduate school, just finishing up in my psychology degree. I got a bachelor's in psychology. And because of the influence of Jay Haley's book, which was mostly about the family therapy aspects of Erickson's work, or the family-oriented aspects of Erickson's work, I became a committed family therapist. So I should be committed, I guess, because that was a crazy approach at the time. And it was very new. And I got my master's in family studies, which was the only degree I could get that was compatible with family therapy and couples and family therapy at the time. So I went out of psychology and into marriage and family therapy and I got a master's degree in that. While I was studying that, I didn't have any money. I was working full time. And Erickson allowed me to become his student because I couldn't pay him by bartering with me and letting me do his gardening. And so I was able to spend a fair amount of time with him, much more than I would have, I guess, if I were just a student, which I would come out once a week. And he loved the garden. He loved nature and outdoors. And he would sit out. By the time I knew him, he was in a wheelchair. He had had polio earlier in his life and then post-polio syndrome later in his life. And he had muscle deterioration. So he was in a wheelchair and couldn't breathe very well. And sometimes couldn't talk very well, was in a great deal of pain. But it sort of seemed to take him out of his pain to spend time in the garden and talking to people and being with people was very much a distraction for him from his pain.
Yeah, you said he was like a Zen master, and this is reminding me of the Karate Kid and Mr. Miyagi, and you're doing wax on, wax off. I wonder if there...
It was like that.
I wonder if there's...
Yes, yes.
Any
All right, I'll tell you one story.
Okay, good.
Yeah,
good.
There were about 10, so we don't have time to go into all of them. But
okay.
I'll tell you one. I had written Dr. Erickson a letter saying, I think somebody should write the story of your life. It's quite inspiring. He got polio, and they told him he was going to be paralyzed for life, and he didn't accept that. And he learned to walk visually. It's a long story, so I won't go into it. Then he got post-polio syndrome, and he got paralyzed again. And he got himself to recover again, even though they said he was paralyzed. And he walked the long walk of the Grand Canyon. Now, some of your listeners will have done the short walk in the Grand Canyon, the hike down, which is a long walk.
Mm-hmm.
But he walked a different route, which was the long walk on two canes to rehabilitate himself.
Mm.
He had great willpower, and he had an interesting life. He'd been born in a boom town in Nevada, Nevada, which no longer exists, a place called Orem, Nevada. And the boom town went bust, and his parents and the family migrated west in a covered wagon. He said that maybe, you know, accounted for the fact that he did everything backwards in his life because they migrated west in a covered wagon instead of east. East in a covered wagon instead of west. I've said that wrong. And so I thought his life was fascinating. So I wrote in the letter that I wrote him to become a student, maybe I should write your biography because I think your life story is fascinating. Maybe I should write an article for Psychology Today for you. That would be interesting.
Mm-hmm.
So I think he was scoping me out. And one of the times that I was there, he gave me a task which was close to impossible. After showing me his scrapbooks and all about his life, he got me to get them down from the bookshelf and we went over them. He brought me out to the backyard and he showed me a carport. And I don't know, again, if your listeners aren't from the Southwest, they may not be able to relate to this. But in the Southwest, the dirt is not like dirt in other parts of the country. It is like concrete. It has a layer called caliche, which is where the minerals leach down when it rains or when the ground gets wet. And they form a concrete-like layer. Sometimes it's an inch below the ground. Sometimes it's a foot below the ground. And you have to almost like have a, you know, I don't know, dynamite to get through it. It's really hard.
Wow.
So he showed me his former carport where his kids had parked their cars when they were growing up. Now they were all gone. And he said, I want to turn this bit into a garden. Now, it was just dirt and a few rocks. And he set me out there with a shovel and potato digger, like a pitchfork, and hoe. And a hose, and I soaked it down, and I would jump on that, you know, potato digger or on that shovel, or I would smash that hoe into the ground. I also had a pickaxe. I couldn't get more than a quarter of an inch down, and the thing would just bounce right off. And I was a skinny, you know, not very athletic or strong kid. I could not get through it. I worked out there for 3 hours, and he finally came out and said, okay, you can stop now. Uh-huh. And he never brought up doing his biography again. I think he knew that I wasn't ready. Uh-huh. And it was, he didn't say, I'm testing you out to see if you're able to do this task of writing my biography, because somebody should write it. He never said that, but he would do things like that. And my first task for him was in his garden. I had to get the nut grass out of the roses. So if you want to think about metaphors, that's a very interesting yes. metaphor. For a psychotherapist in training to get the nut grass out of the roses.
Right. Right, I don't even know.
I didn't even
what
know what nut grass was, but
I don't either. I'll bet you do now,
it's
though.
I know it better than I want to know it because it's a grass again that's really hard to get out. You can pull out the stalks of it, but you don't get. You have to get down to there's a nut about a quarter of an inch below the ground. If you don't get down to that and pull it out, it'll just grow again. So I spent a lot of hours, and he loved it. He was out there talking to me about everything and telling me stories. And at the time, I didn't know, you know, is this guy just senile? Or, you know, is he telling me, is he hypnotizing me? Is he telling me right. therapeutic stories? Is he telling me life-changing stories? And then obviously, after I spent a while with him, it started to sink in. Even though I couldn't articulate what he taught me, I felt that I was a better therapist. I was more confident. I was more creative. And I also started to look at people a little differently. Mm-hmm. I started to look at what worked with them rather than what was wrong with them.
Mm-hmm. Now, I think on your website, I read that you two eventually fell out over a theoretical difference. Is that right, or am I
No, that's
that
not
up?
Exactly right. He and I got along just fine, and he wasn't much of a doctrinaire person. He didn't have a particular fixed approach, so he didn't have to defend any particular approach. But that's never true after someone dies, is it? That someone, an organization springs up around
right,
them that
sure.
gets a little more orthodox and a little more rigid. And I did critique his work and some of his ethics after he died. Many years after
that's what I'm picking up on. So what was your critique?
I was excommunicated from the First Church of Ericksonianism.
Oh, yeah. You know, Jung
and
said,
ask never to darken their doors again.
Jung supposedly said something along the lines of, thank God I'm not a Jungian.
I heard Carl Rogers said that too. I'm no Rogerian. I think, you know, whoever the founders are, they don't get so attached to it having to be done in a certain way.
Right.
It's a little more dynamic to them. And Erikson was definitely like that. He didn't have a fixed way. He actually wanted people to come from different points of view and study with him, anthropologists, biologists, mathematicians, and therapists.
Mm-hmm.
And he wanted to have his work viewed from many, many different approaches because he didn't want it to be closed down in any sort of way.
Yeah.
So I felt I was at least in the tradition of Erikson, but I'm a little irreverent. I'm irreverent above and beyond the call of duty sometimes, and I sometimes put my foot in it, and I put my foot in it, and that was the end of that, and they haven't invited me back since, and which is a shame, because I greatly admire Erikson's work, even though I do have some critiques of it after all these years.
Yeah, what is your critique?
Well, I think there are several critiques. Erikson, you know, Jay Haley said, I spend most of my time when I train therapists trying to restrain them from being helpful in unhelpful ways, and Erikson absolutely believed he knew what was right for people. He maneuvered people a lot, and I think sometimes without checking with them. These days, he would get ethical complaints against him because he didn't do a lot of informed consent. He just did. Sometimes he'd hypnotize somebody who didn't agree to be hypnotized when they were visiting with another patient.
Mm-hmm.
And he'd never tell them they were in treatment. So I think that kind of stuff mm-hmm. is a little shaky.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, again, these are minor parts of Erikson's work, but I thought they ought to be spoken about because we tend to guru-fy these people and, you know, glorify them. And you say, okay, good, they were great, and they had some flaws. Let's all recognize those. Another thing is that Erikson was divorced early on and got custody of his kids, and he had a less, what do I want to say, he was like a psychotically optimistic guy. Everybody who came to see him, he believed, could change. And he worked his buns off and got really creative to make sure they did change. The only cases that I could see where he seemed to give up pretty quickly was couples. He seemed to just say, basically, after he'd seen them for a session or two, your couple's therapy is over. And they would often break up. It's like he gave up thinking you can't really change some people or some relationships. Mm-hmm. And I might give up after a while, but I'd try more than a couple of sessions before I would be discouraged. As a couples and family therapist, I'm pretty optimistic too, but occasionally you don't succeed. But I wouldn't give up quite so quickly. And I think the third thing is that he seemed to have, at least by the time I knew him and some of the cases that that I saw, a bit of a hang-up on young, pretty women. And he sometimes went over the, stepped over the boundaries with that. Now, you know, these, I didn't do a 60-minute investigation. These were cases that were in Jay Haley's book or that he had talked about in public settings. So there were about six or eight cases in which he had women undress. He put his hand under their dress. He exposed part of their breasts. I mean, you know, just weird things like that that were, again, creative and eccentric. But when you start to put six or eight together, it started to become a pattern. And I actually wrote another book about Erickson's work, which is out of print at this time. It's called An Uncommon Casebook. And it was all of Erickson's cases. And my stepdaughter worked with me on it. She was in graduate school for psychology at the time. And she said, you know, some of these cases really bother me. She said Erickson was a dirty old man, wasn't he? And I, you know, that was a little jarring as a phrase.
Yeah.
But I thought, well, he seemed to be a little hung up on exposing women's bodies. And he was such a creative therapist, I think he could have found another way to do it. So when I mentioned that in an unpublished interview that got back to the Erickson Foundation, which had been set up near his death and after his death had thrived, they decided that was irreverence above and beyond the call of duty and criticism that could damage Dr. Erickson. And they thought I was saying it in a mean-spirited way, which I didn't think I was. But we disagreed on that, and we parted ways. And we've parted ways since then, and I've gone off in my own directions.
Yeah, I really appreciate your sharing all of that, because I'm aware that Erickson, you know, pretty much elevated to the status of saint in my own mind to a large degree. But I'm always suspicious when that happens, and always curious to know the other side. So thanks.
Well, let me just interrupt you then, but let me just add one more thing. One time I heard a story which appalled me, that someone had shown a videotape of Erickson's, and he sneezed on the videotape, and they said, oh, that's Erickson's famous sneeze technique. And I was just appalled by that. I thought, that is elevating him to the level of sainthood, where even a sneeze is supposed to be a clever therapeutic maneuver. I think he just sneezed.
Yeah, right. Okay, well, we're we don't have as much time as I'd really like to have to get into all of this.
So, no, because I went on and on about Erickson.
Yeah, but I loved it all. Let's just briefly check in to your NLP experience, neuro-linguistic programming, which we've had one or two shows on before. Based on your experience, what do you see as the strengths and the weaknesses of that approach?
Well, I think the strengths, I studied with Bandler and Grinder in the mid-70s when they were just coming up with their stuff, and I was so excited about it because for the first time someone was making therapeutic patterns explicit. When I was taught psychotherapy, I was taught mostly in an anecdotal way. They didn't even have one-way mirrors very much at the time. They didn't have videotapes. The videotape that I saw was like what most people saw, as Albert Ellis and Fritz Perls and Carl Rogers seeing the same patient, Gloria.
Yeah, right.
And that was the first psychotherapy I had seen other than in the movies and, you know, and just sort of terrible examples of it. And I didn't see much psychotherapy. I heard about it a lot. I practiced it a bit, but I was pretty clueless. Bandler and Grinder came along and said, we're going to study with the best of the best, the three people that we think are great, Milton Erickson, Virginia Satir, and Fritz Perls, who they had access to either tapes or live, you know, observation. They came up with the linguistic and the nonverbal patterns that these people used and tried to make them explicit for therapists, and then they went out and used it for other things as well. I was so excited because they were giving patterns and telling you how to extract patterns. If you saw anybody that did anything great in psychotherapy, you could model on them and get the patterns. I think it started to close down as they got a little more ambitious, what I would like to say greedy as well.
Mm-hmm.
And then they made it into a formula, and it was six-step reframing and visual auditory kinesthetic cues. And they had all these kind of formulaic things, the swish technique. And I found it less interesting at that time. And then it got a little a lot disrespectful to me. Richard started to, you know, kind of threaten people, including me. When he would get upset, you know, he would give you cancer. He would break your legs or something. He threatened to break my legs.
Oh, my goodness.
And, you know, I just thought, what is this? You know, this seems incompatible with caring about people and helping people. So I thought there was an arrogance and a meanness to it, and I just sort of drifted back out of it after it started to become called neurolinguistic programming, which wasn't until 1978. And in 1979, I just left, and I thought, I'm much more interested in Erickson's work. I'm going to go back to that. This NLP stuff doesn't seem as great to me. Now, other people have gone on and done it in a very ethical and good way, but I drifted away from it. I occasionally still teach for NLP people, and I wrote my master's thesis on Bandler and Grinder's Patterns of Communication and Change, which wasn't called NLP at the time. That was in 1977, and I finished it in 1978, and then they came up with that title of Neurolinguistic Programming. So I was in it for a while. I edited the first NLP newsletter from 1978 to 1980, and then I was certified in 1978, and then I just drifted away into Erickson's work, and then later I developed my own approach, as I mentioned, solution-oriented therapy.
Well, let's get into that. Because I'm sure you'd like to share that with the world out there. Tell us a bit about solution-oriented therapy and how you developed that.
Well, you know, I do want to share it with the world, but I wanted to say that I'm just finishing my 27th book, so I've done a lot of sharing with the world, and I've got a lot of credit for things. I'm much more interested in talking about Erickson because I just think he's still underrated and other people should know about him. But I'll give you a quick summary. Erickson did many, many things, but one of the things he did was he tried to find what was working in people's lives, what resources and abilities he had. He was really a resource-oriented therapist at base, I think. And that influenced me so much because what I was learning in graduate school and undergraduate school was pathology. What was wrong with people? What had damaged people? What genetic problems they had? What biochemical problems they had? What personality problems they had? What traumas they had suffered? What bad environments they'd been in? Or where they were stuck? And, you know, it's useful stuff to know, I think. But sometimes when we focus on it, we lose one part of the therapeutic benefits of things, which is people get discouraged. And we know from Jerome Frank on to more recent research of Wampold and other researchers that, and Lambrecht and all these people that have told us that hope and positive expectancy has a great deal to do with positive outcomes in psychotherapy.
Yes, that's a drum I beat as well.
Dealing hope.
Yeah.
I think it's a great drum to beat. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, we as therapists, because we have to be trained in this, like doctors have to be trained to recognize illness, but doctors aren't so well trained to recognize wellness or in enhancing wellness. Erickson was one of the early wellness doctors, if you want to talk about in psychiatry. He thought people did have resources and abilities and that they were naturally healthy. Now, again, Maslow and, you know, Girard and some other people in psychology thought that as well. But in clinical work, that wasn't the main thing. So Erickson sort of created this sweep towards health and resources and wellness. And I took that and made it into a thing I called solution-oriented therapy. Steve DeShazer, another colleague, at the same time was creating something called solution-focused therapy, which is a little more formulaic, and I don't like formula much in clinical work, so I sort of stayed away from that. But solution-oriented is finding out what resources, abilities, solutions, previous solutions, exceptions people had, also focuses not so much on the past and what traumas happened, but if we go back to the past, we find resources and solutions, or it focuses on the present toward the future. And Erickson was a big future-oriented psychotherapist. He thought that if people had a dream or a vision for the future or a sense of hope and possibility for the future, that they would often solve their own problems. So he used a lot of future-oriented techniques. And I just formularized those a little more or gave some guidelines for how do you evoke from people their resources, their competence, their abilities, and how do you give them hope towards a future without the problem. So I call that solution-oriented therapy. I wrote a book about it called In Search of Solutions with Michelle Wiener Davis. And then I've written about four or five other books on that particular topic, solution-oriented therapy for chronic and severe mental illness. I wrote a book on using solution-oriented therapy to treat sexual abuse after effects called Even from Broken Web. And I've written books on brief couples therapy from a solution-oriented point of view. This tends to be a briefer therapy.
Yeah.
And then because it was getting confused. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say it's very timely given the pressures of managed care where there's been a lot of pressure to shorten up therapy to be able to handle more people more quickly. So it's very timely.
It's sort of what made it. Yeah, it's sort of what made it take off. But I had come up with it before managed care and those pressures came along because mm-hmm. I was excited about if you can tap into people's resources, they can change pretty quickly. If you have to correct their deficits, it's going to take a longer time. So it was a naturally briefer therapy. And when managed care and all the pressures from third-party funders came along and said, we need to see results and we don't want to spend all our budget on, you know, seeing people for 2 or 3 years if it's not necessary. And the research was showing that the average number of outpatient sessions, no matter what your theoretical orientation was in North America, was 4 to 6 sessions. But that wasn't true for every therapist. Some therapists were seeing people an average of 72 sessions
right.
or 26 sessions.
Yeah.
And so they said, if the average is 4 to 6 sessions, why don't we train everybody so we can at least do brief therapy for the vast majority of people who can benefit from therapy briefly and then keep some more of the resources. That was the original theory. Keep some more of the resources for the really chronic and severely disturbed people who are going to need hospitalizations and longer care and more frequent care. Now, that isn't the way it actually came out with managed care. It turned out to be a money-saving technique, which I was disappointed in when it actually fell out. But initially, the vision of managed care was, let's be very efficient with people we can be, and not just because the therapists have a bias towards long-term therapy, let's just do long-term therapy with everybody. And if we can be very efficient with the people who can benefit from brief therapies or shorter-term therapies, then we can have the resources to treat either more people or the people who need more extensive and intensive care.
Yeah. I don't know if you can answer this next question or not, but you've written 27 books. You do workshops all over the country and even all over the world. You run a clinic. You see clients. You're a husband and a father, I think. How do you do it all?
Well, let me say a few things. I don't do clinical work anymore. Like you, I've given it up. I only write and teach. That's been the last few years.
Okay.
I had 4 kids. I was a step-parent and a biological parent. And that was a challenging time. I wrote 10 books in 10 years with 4 kids and a half-time practice and a half-time teaching, you know, writing life, I guess professional life. And I didn't get much sleep. Let's say that. And I like to sleep. But what drove me or pulled me, I guess I'd rather say, because I don't feel so driven. I'm kind of a lazy guy. What pulled me was my passion. And, you know, I don't think, you know, you're doing this podcast, you're doing this interview. There's no way you would take this extra time unless you had a passion for psychology
true.
And
yeah.
for talking to people. It pulls you through a lot if you find what it is that you love to do or what it is that you're upset about. I say there's 2 energies that pull people in life. One is what blisses them out, and one is what pisses them off. And so I was sort of both. I loved Erickson's work, and I loved psychotherapy. I thought it was a sacred calling. And I was sort of pissed off that there was some discouraging stuff. You know, now in psychology, all this positive psychology stuff with Martin Seligman leading the way has come out. But at the time, there wasn't much positive psychology. It was almost always analyzing the negativity or the problems in people. And that pissed me off because I thought, they're not seeing, the rest of my colleagues, a lot of my colleagues aren't seeing the strengths and the wellness in people. And it upset me because I thought they're dismissing people's possibilities for change. And that's what pulled me to write books and teach workshops. Mm-hmm. I was a shy person at the time. I wasn't a naturally good writer. I had to learn to write, and I had to learn to teach and get over my fears as public speaking. But that's what pulled me through, and that's what continually – I think, okay, I've written enough books. 26 books is enough. 27 books is enough. That's enough. And then I'll wake up in the middle of the night with a new idea that I'm so excited about, I can't stop myself from getting up in the middle of the night and jotting down the outline. And it annoys me. I'd rather sleep, actually. But I feel such a – a calling to contribute to the world. And if I have something that can contribute and touch some one person's life, then that's good enough for me. I wrote a book and I was on Oprah, and this woman contacted me and told me a year after the book was out how it had changed her life. She'd gotten it out of a serious addiction to painkillers by reading my book, and I thought, okay, it's all over but the shouting for me. I can die now.
Yeah,
I've done my
yeah.
job on the planet. One person at least, and I know I probably touched more than that, but she told me a story that made my whole book writing career worthwhile because I had gotten her out of an addiction and perhaps saved her life. I'd never met her, and there was nothing more satisfying to that than that for me in my professional life.
Well, that's a wonderful place for us to close, and I really want to thank you for giving me this interview. And I'm going to get into one of your workshops somewhere, sometime. Love to meet
please.
You and hang out with you.
Well, thank you so much. I listened to your podcast, and I'm totally fascinated by some of the people you've had on. I recommend to other people that the people listening to this one, go listen to some of the others. They are great. You're a great interviewer, and you get fascinating people on.
Okay, thanks a lot. You've been shrunk and wrapped.
Okay.
Okay, bye-bye. Psychotic enthusiasm indeed. I wish I had a thimble full of Bill's energy. I think it would take me a long way. His enthusiasm really comes through, and I hope you were as energized by it as I was. Thanks again, Bill, if you listen back to this. Bill's a great storyteller, and his book, Taproots, is full of great Milton Erickson stories. I'll put a link to it in the show notes. Of course, this evokes another one of Dr. Dave's stories. I'll make this one short. If you've been a regular listener, you'll recall my story about my initial attempt at being a stage hypnotist from episode number 45. If you haven't listened to that one, you might want to listen to it before you listen to this most recent story. So here's the rest of the story, which I'll call The Amazing Whitman Sails Again.
The Amazing Whitman.
It's been many years since my exciting but brief career, a one-night stand, really, as stage hypnotist The Amazing Whitman at the Ramada Inn in Orlando, Florida. I've gotten a lot of mileage over the years recounting my encounter with the mafioso talent agent who challenged me with, "Hey, Whitman, hypnotize my thumb." Telling the story of this humiliating experience has turned a lemon into lemonade, helped me to heal from the trauma, and strengthened my resolve to never, ever put myself in such a situation again. Consequently, I have the strength some years later to turn down a friend's offer to, quotes, do my stage hypnotist act, end quote, for a graduating class of newly trained hypnotists from her hypnotherapy academy. It seems my story of my showbiz debacle has only enhanced my reputation, but I vowed to myself that the Valium-induced Amazing Whitman will not ride again. So much for strong resolutions. My friend Cooch is a tarot reader, and she looks every bit the gypsy. Although she takes tarot quite seriously, she's made a good living on the side doing it as entertainment at various corporate gigs in the Bay Area. One day, some years back, she approaches me with the suggestion that I do my stage hypnosis act for a Hornblower Yachts cruise. Hornblower Yachts is a very large and successful franchise that takes groups out on lunch and dinner cruises in various coastal cities in the U.S. Frequently, there will be some sort of entertainment as part of the package, perhaps a band, or a magician, or a tarot reader. Cooch tells me that she has an inside track with the talent booking person at Hornblower, and that they have an upcoming event where they need some talent for a lunch cruise. And they'll pay me $300. I'd get a free lunch, a free cruise on the San Francisco Bay, and $300, all for about 30 or 40 minutes of hypnotic entertainment. Cooch butters me up, telling me how talented I am and how much experience and expertise I have, and so on, and reminds me that I tend to worry too much. It'll be great. I guess enough time has gone by that I've forgotten just how painful the Ramada Inn experience actually was. And besides that, this presents an opportunity to prove to myself and the world that that debacle was just a fluke. So of course, I agree to take on this ocean cruising gig. Well, if I learned anything in the Ramada Inn disaster, it was to reinforce what I already knew, namely the importance of audience mindset and expectation. I think they need to know that there's going to be a stage hypnotist, and they need to come with that expectation and a willingness to have a good time with it. If they're expecting to see a hypnotist, they're already halfway hypnotized. Now, I emphasize this to Cooch. Be sure to tell the Hornblower people to let the people on the lunch cruise know that there's going to be a hypnotist, I say. Be sure that there is signage to that effect, I say. Comes the day of the cruise. I show up at the dock. There's no signage. The lunch is not that good, and I can't eat much of it anyway, because there's no room in my stomach, what with all the butterflies in there. Not only is there no signage, but over lunch I discover that none of these cruisers have been told that there's going to be a hypnotist. To make matters worse, I discover that these are business people who are there to network and make an impression on one another. Lunch is served on a bunch of folding tables that have been set up in a below decks area. As lunch is winding down, it's my time to get up and perform. Once again, I'm more or less trying to wing it. I call for volunteers, and it's like pulling teeth. My audience is clearly surprised and puzzled to discover that there's this hypnotist as part of their networking event, and they're the most resistant crowd I've ever seen. To make a long story short, and in fact I've forgotten a lot of the details due to the healing and protective powers of repression, I'm dying up there. Finally, I see the dock coming back into view inasmuch as we're on the return leg of the trip. I've never been so happy to see a dock before. I'm dying up there, I tell you. It is with considerable relief that I announce, "Well, folks, I'd like to show you more. But we're about to land. You've been a great audience." Note to self: never, never, ever attempt to do stage hypnosis with an audience that is not expecting you. Never, never, ever attempt to do stage hypnosis with a bunch of business people who are all trying to make a good business impression on one another. They just won't be willing to act like they're chickens, or that they have no clothes on, or that they are Madonna singing Material Girl. But how about a stand-up comedy act in which I act like I'm a hypnotist who can't get anyone to cooperate? Folks, we have an unexpected treat for you this evening. Comedian The Amazing Whitman has agreed to do a guest shot. Let's hear it for The Amazing Whitman.
Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head.
Okay, everybody. Because I'm running a bit long, I'm going to skip reading the email and welcoming those of you who've put yourself on our Frapper map. For now, I'll just say thanks for those wonderful emails, and thanks for putting yourselves on the map. In just 5 days, I take off for 11 days in Italy, and I want to make sure you get your shrink wrap radio fix for September. So before I leave, that's in just the next few days, I'm planning to put out 2 more shows, just so that you'll have at least 4 shows for September. Just a brief reminder that you can use the code SHRINK3 at checkout for a great discount at GoDaddy.com. And next time I'll tell you about the new domain name I just bought there. Now, even when I'm away in Italy, I'll be able to read your emails on my BlackBerry. You know I live for those emails. They'll mean so much to me when I'm so far away from home. You can send them to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. Both The Amazing Whitman and I would like to thank Bill O'Hanlon for being a most stimulating guest. As I say, the next episode should follow close on the heels of this one and will feature my interview with DreamWork author and lecturer Jeremy Taylor. You won't want to miss that one. We close with the PodSafe tune Energy because Bill O'Hanlon has so much of it and because I get so much of it when I hear from you. It's by Australian Leanne Bugatt, and you'll find it in our show notes and on the PodSafe Music Network. That's it for now. This is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
Soaking in the light. Oh, so much beauty. Oh, what a wonderful sight. Energy coming from the trees. Flow. Without this magnificent scene, the sun is shining bright, not a cloud in the sky. The day will soon be over. feel the centipedes from the quietness here. Something I can have with ease any day, any hour. Energy coming from the tree. Without this magnificent scene.